You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, the FBI, Clinton, and what it all means for the last 24 hours of the campaign.
The rank and file special agents at the FBI won't let her get away with her terrible crimes.
My guests, Zania Wickett and James Boyes, will be analysing this and the other big themes on the eve of the US election, including: at what point over the election cycle did America realise that Donald Trump had turned from comedy figure to serious presidential threat? And what else is on the election ballot in 2016? We'll be talking life, death, marijuana and condoms. Plus, as one of the most unpleasant elections in living memory draws to a close, we'll be asking what can be done to prevent the lows of this year being repeated in 4 years' time. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to the programme and a warm welcome to my guests today. Zania Wickett, head of the US and Americas programme at Chatham House, and to the political historian specialising in the United States, James Boyes. Welcome both back to the show. Good to have you with us. We start with a bit of a roundup of the latest from the last weekend of the campaign. The headlines have been dominated by the FBI's, well, fumbled investigation into Hillary Clinton's email server. Director James Comey squarely in the firing line. Comey's being criticised now from all sides for having seemingly needlessly intervened in the national discourse by bringing the Clinton case back into the news agenda personally and then failing to provide any new incriminating evidence. Zania, what do you make of this FBI wrangle? I guess the claim and counterclaim from respectively Clinton and Trump is understandable, but has this just been misjudged by Comey? Did he anticipate a different outcome? It looks like a shambles. What's your view?
So let me say two things. I mean, the first is that, like so many of the October surprises or September or November surprises, as the case may be, I'm not sure that it made a huge difference to the results. So when Donald Trump's video came out, Hollywood video came out, huge impact on the polls. 2 days later, the polls were back where they were before. So everybody knew about the emails. I don't think it's probably going to make that much difference to the way people thought about Clinton to hear that the investigation might be open again any more than I think it now makes terribly much difference to hear that it isn't open again. So the first thing to say is, yes, both sides will say this swung it, et cetera, et cetera, but it probably isn't going to make that much difference. The second thing to say about the emails, about what Comey did is, the rules show very, very clearly that he was wrong in revealing this. 60 days before an election, you're not supposed to reveal anything that might affect the election. This clearly did affect, clearly could have affected the election, and therefore he was wrong to do it. On the other hand, let's just play out the alternate scenario. Mm. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't do anything. This comes to light in, say, late November, early December, which almost certainly it would. Somebody would leak it. Donald Trump, assuming he loses, would get out there and say, this could have affected the election. It was, you know, I was cheated, da da da. And you have huge cacophony of chaos. And any mandate that Hillary might have won in this scenario is out the window very, very quickly as all hell breaks loose. And so actually, the repercussions of doing it when he did it versus leaving it and it coming out in a couple of months, actually the repercussions are probably less doing it the way he's did it. Does that make it right? No, of course it doesn't. But at some level, you can see he's stuck between a rock and a hard place, and the repercussions of leaving it until after the election were probably almost certainly going to be an awful lot worse.
In a word or two, Joe, do you think that Comey could be in bother? Because, as you say, according to the letter of the law or the convention, that's not really the
thing. I don't see any scenario whereby Comey is still FBI director in a year from now. Mm. Not because, I mean, FBI director is not a political appointee, but I just don't see how he credibly sustains his position with Congress, with the president, whoever that president might be. I don't see how he does it.
Do you think that there's a question around the impression of various, you know, whether they're different departments, government agencies, around the impartiality? You know, people seem to kind of know how it all works. Do you think this throws that into a different focus, James?
We have to be a little bit careful not to get too conspiratorial here, I think. On the other hand, it's important to note that Fox News, of all places, ran an article in which they referred to J. Edgar Comey, very much damning him for doing this. So he's getting that. It was coming from.
So do you go along with that right. broader point that Zenia was making, which was that he was caught?
Yeah. I do, but where I would. And I don't know. Then you might agree with me on this. My issue with it was, yes, he was between a rock and a hard place. But the problem with it was how he went about doing this. It's possible that he could have done this in a more discreet fashion by sending the letter in the way he did, which had all the appearance of a press release, effectively. That was the problem. I think if there'd been a way of doing this discreetly, so he... Maybe I'm not being naive here, but I'm trying to give him the credit, you know, the benefit of the doubt here. If he could have done it in such a way as to say, look, we've found this raft of materials. We're not sure what's on it yet. We're informing you that we're looking at it. The challenge, of course, is that when that letter was sent, they didn't have a search warrant. They had no idea what was on it. And Newsweek are breaking a story over the last 24 hours, basically suggesting that the agents involved knew within 24 hours that basically these were just duplicates and that this has taken far too long to get to this point. Now, I know Donald Trump's saying, oh, you can't count 650,000 emails in just over a week. But of course, you don't do that. You go through metadata and you do a whole series of computer programs to basically look at these things. So, you know, is it a mess? Absolutely. I think where I would slightly differ with Zenia is just in that issue of momentum. Before this story broke last Friday, there was a sense that was momentum growing behind Hillary Clinton. She had moved on looking at down ticket race a little bit more than focusing on Donald Trump. We're going to talk a little bit about some of the issues on ballots later on. This could have had an impact upon that. I think what it will do perhaps is reduce her overall majority slightly. Not excessively. I don't think it will change the output. And as Zenia rightly pointed out, we're back to, you know, about a 4-point lead, which is where we've been on and off throughout an awful lot of the fall campaign, I think.
I was going to say, Zenia, I'm not sure you agree with that. There was a bit of head shaking. But I mean, is one of the problems, Trump's constantly gone back to this narrative that, you know, Hillary's guilty, she's crooked, she can't be trusted. So I guess one could argue that whether or not there's the impression of something or the impression of the other from this email issue, he's been banging that drum the whole time, and he's probably going to get as much credence with the voting public as he was going to get by it.
So, I mean, here's what I'd say. First of all, the polls were already swinging his way when this came out. So, yes, Hillary had gone from being 4 or 5 points ahead, but post the third debate, the polls were already swinging back towards Trump. And so did this hasten the swing back of the polls? Possibly, possibly not. We'll never know the answer to that. But the polls were definitely swinging in Trump's favor. I made an argument shortly after the Comey released his letter, which is, and at that point, Clinton was, I tend to stick to the Real Clear Politics, aggregate of aggregate polls, although I don't have a lot of faith in the polls, I should add that. And they were showing her 4 or 5 points ahead coming out of the third debate when the letter was then released. The trend was against her. She went down to, on last Friday, 1.5 points ahead. She's now 1.8 points ahead. So again, it's slightly kind of moving in her direction, but that's where it's sitting. But I made the argument that actually 5 points ahead was the most dangerous place for Clinton to be. 5 points ahead is absolutely breachable because we've seen swings on the polls versus the actual election of 4 or 5 points. That's what Romney was supposed to win by 1 point. Obama won by 4 points in the end. So, I mean, that's totally breachable. And at 5 points ahead, an awful lot of people will be complacent and won't come out and vote for her because they don't particularly like her. And we can talk about the incredible negativity ratings for both Trump and Hillary Clinton. This is about voting for who you dislike least. And if she's 5 points ahead, people aren't going to come out and vote for her. If she's 1 point ahead or perhaps 2 points ahead or 1.8 as she is today or was this morning, that complacency is gone. That is too close. So oddly enough, I actually think it helps her to be this close I was more worried in a sense of how would this play out and whether people would come out for her when she was 5 points ahead. So ironically, this actually may help her.
We'll come back to some of those themes you've mentioned in a moment. I actually wanted to look back in time a little, James, just next, because we learned today about the passing of Janet Reno, mm-hmm. who was diagnosed with Parkinson's, I think, sure. back in the mid-90s when she was still serving as Attorney General. Of course, she was the first woman to take that role. She served two terms, and she died today. It's very hard when a figure like that passes not to ask what they would have made of what we're seeing now. And for obvious reasons, we didn't really hear any pronouncements from Janet Reno. What do you think, you know, this very formidable, impressive woman, what would she have made of this race, do you think?
Crikey. Well, I think that, like most people, she would be deeply disturbed by the overall tone of it, the lack of intellectual engagement which is going on. Difficult to say exactly where that is originating from without obviously pointing fingers at Donald Trump. I think that, you know, I think Hillary would have liked to have made this more issues related, to be honest, because she's not someone who, by her own admission, is a particularly great politician. She is someone who... Whose personality comes through more on a one-to-one basis rather than in a big auditorium. So, you know, this idea of a lack of a policy-led, a campaign is problematic. But, you know, it's interesting because, of course, you know, you've got a very interesting relationship between the two women. When Bill Clinton became president in the election of 1992, you know, a lot of people were initially saying, well, Hillary could be Attorney General. Well, of course, that was dismissing American law, which, of course, there was a law passed. It's often referred to as the Bobby Kennedy law to prevent political nepotism, effectively. It might have been easier, quite frankly, if she could have served as AG, because, of course, Bill Clinton had a Hillary problem, just as now Hillary has a Bill problem. You know, what do you do with such a talented partner in the White House, effectively? It was Hillary Clinton's determination that America needed to have a woman Attorney General. And first of all, of course, they got one individual in who wasn't able to be confirmed because of indiscretions with regard to taxation issues, Zoe Baird. Then they turned to Kimber Wood, who had the similar issues, as well as having served as a Playboy waitress at one point. And eventually they went down to the swamps of Florida and they found Janet Reno, who served for 4 years. And in many ways, it's kind of funny, you know, you see in Janet Reno and also in Madeleine Albright, arguably, this idea that you have two formidable women at the heart of the Clinton administration who have got more, I'll use an expression Madeleine Albright famously used, what's cojones, than many of the men working around Bill Clinton. You know, they were formidable. Madeleine Albright on foreign policy, who acted as a scholar for Hillary Clinton, later as sextant, and Janet Reno, who, you know, when Waco went horribly, horribly wrong, it was Janet Reno who went before the press and basically assumed responsibility and offered to resign for it, and really showed up Bill Clinton in that first couple of weeks of his term in office as being someone who really needed to get on the front foot. And it was the lessons from the Waco situation that the Clinton administration subsequently put into place around Oklahoma when that all went wrong that allowed Bill Clinton to eventually find his presidential footing and presidential voice.
Janet Reno, as you pointed out, who took responsibility, put her hands up, you know, the kind of voice perhaps lacking a little on the scene now. More of which in a moment. We are around, 36 short hours away from learning whether Hillary or Donald Trump will become the next president of the US. Clinton certainly had her share of the critics, but Trump's ascent from a big mouth billionaire stereotype, a TV star, to being a contender for the White House, a genuine contender and a highly divisive figure, has nevertheless caught people off guard. How exactly did we get here? Let's listen to how the national punchline that was Donald Trump became a joke that very few are laughing at today.
I'm going to make America great again. Politicians aren't going to do that. And everybody takes me very seriously. Business Week magazine has an article. What do the Chinese most want? One of the 10 things. Anything Trump. People think I don't like China. I love China. I sold an apartment for $55 million to a Chinese gentleman.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only Rosie O'Donnell
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no? As a principle?
Yeah, it has to be some form.
10 cents, 10 years.
I don't
what?
Know. That I don't know.
What about the guy that gets her pregnant? Determined. Is he responsible under the law for these abortions?
I would say no.
That's Donald Trump. Zenia, how did we get here? I mentioned in that little introduction that it caught people off guard, but it's funny that something that takes so long can catch so many off guard. Is that really what happened, or is the narrative here, would you sort of calibrate it differently than that?
I would say what took us off guard, and this, by the way, happened on the left as well as the right. Donald Trump was the manifestation of this on the right, and of course Bernie Sanders the manifestation of this on the left. What has taken so many off guard and what has taken so many elites off guard is the really significant part of the American population who feel disenfranchised, who feel left behind, who have really hurt through these 8 or so years of recession and aren't seeing the benefits, aren't seeing us come out of that recession, for whom the standard of living has dropped and they still haven't gotten back to the standard of living of 2008. And we knew they existed, but they didn't exist on our TVs and in our living rooms and in our lives. And so what has really taken people off guard is that not only do they exist, we knew this, but that they exist in such numbers and they have found their voice. And their voice is Bernie Sanders on the left and Donald Trump. And you will say, yes, but Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are two very, very different people. Yes, but they're representing the same kind of angst in the American populace, the people who just don't see a way forward. And so we have been, and we continue to be, incredibly surprised by how loud these people are and how many of these people there are. Mm. And I look today, we talk about, some people talk about Donald Trump being a joke, and you say, well, actually, no, he's representing a lot of those people. He's also, by the way, representing your standard Republican voter who may not like the package but likes the policies, and Donald Trump is coming out with the standard Republican policies. And if they're religious, they absolutely find Hillary Clinton's liberal values so incredibly distasteful. And the idea that Hillary Clinton would have an opportunity to put a liberal on the Supreme Court, absolutely terrifying. And yet, if you are a liberal, if you are mainstream, you get distracted by the package that is Donald Trump rather than the content that is Donald Trump, which is entirely different.
James, it's a pretty damning indictment, I guess, and this echoes a conversation we had across, I was going to say Britain, but across Europe, really, that if you have that level of angst, that level of dissatisfaction, that perception of disenfranchisement almost, you're looking for an alternative. We reeled off the, I'll reluctantly call it a highlight reel of some Donald Trump moments there. If that person can look like the light at the end of the tunnel, then the whole political class and almost the political process is surely in a bit of a crisis, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. There's no doubt about it. I think that a lot of people are talking about, you know, does this spell the end of the GOP? I have to say that after this election cycle, I think both parties really need to take a long, hard look at themselves, because if Hillary Clinton gets elected, to my mind, she represents the end of a cycle that begins arguably with Bill Clinton and, you know, obviously Janet Reno coming to office in 1993. So the Democrats need to think about where they go next, as do the GOP, quite frankly. We look back at how and why Donald Trump emerged, however. You know, if you go back to the primaries, I think what was telling about that, though, was that there appeared to be a ceiling within each primary election that was held, effectively, that Donald Trump simply couldn't breach. Not that anybody else came particularly close to him particularly, but there were so many other people in that race. And one wonders whether in hindsight, if the GOP really wanted to stop him, if they had, you know, somehow said, right, you know what, we're going to coalesce around a stop Donald candidate, effectively, you know, whether they could have coalesced enough of a support, because clearly there was certainly, you know, a groundswell of support amongst a section of the Republican electorate in the primary that was going to support Donald Trump. But there was also a majority, it must be said, who were not, that they were supporting somebody else. And I think if they could, the GOP could have found a viable alternative out of those 14, 15 other candidates, some of whom, it must be said, were, you know, ridiculously well funded. I mean, Jeb Bush had a fortune to spend and did so relatively poorly, it must be pointed out. That's not to say that Jeb Bush necessarily was the right person, but I do think that on this election cycle, if you look at the cycles of American history, the Republican Party could have won this election with the right candidate. Hillary Clinton is not a great candidate. You've got 8 years of Barack Obama. Americans tend to vote two terms per party and move on in a cycle, with relatively few exceptions in the last 50 or 60 years. They haven't done that. And I think if Donald Trump loses this, it will be a question of the GOP will have lost it because of him. I think if they could have found a stronger, more centrist candidate, then he could have appealed to the groups and the demographics which are emerging in the United States, which are vital for any winning candidacy.
But, Zenia, I wonder what you think about that, because presumably it would have been a hard sell for any centrist candidate, because it sounds like people want change, or the perception of change, and that said, you know, middle ground, safe pair of hands wouldn't offer that up. Is this a problem then for the GOP? Is it a personnel problem for the GOP, or does it tap into this wider issue? We saw it on the Democrat side, as you said, a sort of a mirror of sorts with this great power that seemed to shift towards Bernie, again, far to the left of anything we would normally have expected.
So James is absolutely right that if you had taken all of the voters for all of the other candidates, then you probably, and put them in one candidate, you probably would have had a result. And there's no question that the fact that the primaries was, there were so many candidates, everybody was taking votes from one another, and that stopped it. But that was never going to happen. You're never going to see Marco Rubio take a back seat to Jeb Bush or Ted Cruz. I mean, it's unrealistic. Everybody, unfortunately, as is often the case in politics, was going for themselves. And I do think it underestimates. I mean, one of the reasons that Donald Trump has been so successful, and that Bernie Sanders was so successful, I mean, far more successful than anybody predicted, is because truly the parties have lost sight and aren't willing to acknowledge, as it were, the huge numbers of people who have been left behind by the system. And they're up in arms now, and they're ready to engage. And the problem is that politicians aren't willing to actually get out in front and say, you know what, we have a real problem. The social contract that we signed up for 70 or 80 years ago no longer adds up. When we can no longer make the choices we've been making, we're going to actually have to say less defense spending, or less international security, or less infrastructure, or less education, or less Medicare or Medicaid. And politicians don't want to say that, because they know that if they say that, then they won't get elected. And so nobody is, as it were, fessing up to the challenge. And that means nobody's actually dealing with the challenge, which is why these disenfranchised continue to be disenfranchised. That is the biggest problem that the next president is going to have to deal with, is how do they deal with re-engaging with these people, bringing them into the system, when we don't have an economy that actually has vast amounts of money to spare to do that. Incredibly hard, and in a very, very partisan environment.
It just makes me wonder. I mean, Bernie Sanders was coming out with that kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a hypothetical, but do you think he could have beaten Trump? Do you think he would have beaten Trump had he got the Democratic nomination?
I think it would have been extraordinarily interesting candidacy, and it would have been much more about actually here. I think both candidates, particularly Bernie Sanders, would have run under a much more positive.
Well, we might have had to have seen a bit more substance.
It would have been somebody you're voting for. Well, I'm not sure that you would have seen more substance, but it would have been somebody you're voting for rather than who do you dislike more, which is where we are today.
There's plenty more on the ballot in tomorrow's election. Let's ask Zenia and James about this. As well as the vote to decide who's going to sit in the White House, there are more than 150 other issues in states across the US that will be decided, from states on the West Coast looking to legalize marijuana use to California pornography performers campaigning against being made to wear condoms by the state on set. Other issues range from Florida's approach to green energy to Americans' right to hunt fish, and others besides. James, it is interesting, and it's understandable that maybe these things pale, I guess, in comparison to the big question. But do you think we see potentially deciding factors that maybe go by the wayside a little bit?
Yeah, maybe. And I think what's fascinating about this is that you're not hearing these issues coming necessarily from the two main candidates themselves. I mean, when was the last time you heard Donald Trump talking about the issues that you've just listed? It's just simply not happening. And again, you know, coming back to something we were talking about at the top of the program, this idea of, you know, the impact that some of these stories have had about potentially with removing trust from Hillary Clinton. You know, if Because one of the problems, of course, you've got is, you know, people are assuming, maybe listening to this, that everybody's trucking off to the polls on Tuesday morning, whereas, of course, you know, 30, 40% of Americans have already voted. So, you know, you've got an awful lot of people out there who've already voted on some of these issues and done so on the basis of, you know, facts that may or may not be accurate. And, of course, some of these issues that are going to have large implications for the local communities, particularly on the West Coast, for example, is issues to do with legalizing marijuana, for example. So, you know, a lot of social issues. And again, when you think about the demographic makeup of the country, when you think about where this is heading, you know, if we're assuming that Hillary Clinton's going to win this narrowly, the suggestion is she could take a very slight lead into the Senate as well with it. So, you know, the drift in the country, a lot of people talk about, you know, the conservative makeup of the Supreme Court, for example. Well, that could completely change if you end up with, you know, a Hillary Clinton presidency being able to, you know, put people onto the Supreme Court. The perceived Republican conservative drift of the Supreme Court could certainly change. And that's one of the reasons that, as Zenya rightly pointed out, the right are so fearful, I think, of Hillary Clinton, and will come back to the Republican Party at the last minute, which you've seen on a sort of attempt to stop Hillary Clinton.
Zenya, do you think sometimes you could always learn more about where modern America is by looking at some of these more nuanced things rather than the big picture? It's hard to look away from, you know, the main event, if you like. But do you think that we're a little, I don't know, almost myopic about it, and we miss some of the kind of interesting stuff that's happening at the periphery?
Well, I think yes and no. I mean, we often talk about California being a bellwether in political terms and in progressive terms. You know, watch what happens to California and then you'll see that slowly and sometimes quite quickly drift across the United States. Some of that is incredibly positive. Much of that is incredibly, as somebody who votes in California, much of that is incredibly positive. You've seen over the last 5 or 6 years, California change its the rules by which it creates counties, so getting rid of gerrymandering, making that far more independent. You've seen California change the way it runs its primaries so that you can have the top two candidates rather than Democratic and Republican candidate. And what that does is, of course, mean that the candidates are much more middle of the road rather than at the extremes. So, I mean, you know, you're seeing California. But what I would say about these, and I will say, you know, I mean, I had to vote in California and I can't remember how many questions I had to vote on. I was not just voting on the president and congressional candidates, but, you know, vast number of referenda questions, if you will, type questions, if you will. But one of the reasons that makes this election just so incredibly sensitive to so many people on both the conservative and the liberal side is, if you look at them, I've lived outside of the United States now for 8 years. So I left shortly before President Obama was elected. And I look at the country from outside and I am absolutely stunned by how far the country has moved liberal. If you had asked me that we would have gay marriage kind of taking the country by force, if you had asked me that we would be debating what bathroom people should use, that you would have had, you know, gays in the military, on all sorts of liberal issues, I have been amazed by how far the country has moved. So if you are conservative and you watch these elections, this is absolutely terrifying because Hillary looks more left than Obama. Well, and thus this is terrifying. And if you are liberal, that's exactly what you want, because it's not just one Supreme Court justice. We know that this president will choose one Supreme Court justice. This president could choose 4 out of 9 Supreme Court justices.
And that's potentially
And that could fundamentally
impactful.
Change the America that we know. Well, this no wonder like- people are going back to their roots in some respects.
Well,
this
I wanted to ask you about this, and we said at the top that we'd ask you about how we make sure this race, which has been problematic and difficult to watch at some times, is this the shape of things to come? James, what do you make of that idea? Do you think that, exactly as Zenya says then, you've got a speed of change, a shift towards many kind of liberal social policy areas that's just too fast for many people? We know about the divisiveness of Donald Trump. Are we just looking at a country that's too riven? And so inevitably, we could be seeing a race like this again when it comes to 2020.
Well, you know, one of the things that Barack Obama said very famously that brought him to national prominence back in 2004, when he put John Kerry's name into the mix at the convention that year, is that there's no red state and no blue states. There's only the United States. It's a great line. Give him that. Unfortunately, it's also not true. There is fundamentally a red state America and there's a blue state America. And that actually gets broken down even more when you look at the individual breakup of each state. You know, you get a very, very clear split between the cities and the rural areas effectively going blue and red. So there is great division in the country. As Zenya rightly pointed out, it has certainly moved leftward during the last 8 years under Barack Obama. Many people, I think, have thought that this president hasn't managed to get through a lot of what he wanted. Yet here we are now at the end of his term in office, and Zenya rightly pointed out, we've got, you know, the Republicans are not talking about gay marriage anymore. It's basically been accepted as by fiat, effectively. You've got the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, a whole raft of issues, which has signified the move leftward. You know, the great question about, you know, how can we prevent this happening again, almost, you know, which has been asked, is, well, great, you do what Donald Trump wants. You make America great again. You go back to the 1950s, which he wants. And yet, ironically, at that point, the parties didn't basically choose their candidate by primary. They were chosen by the party elders, which would have precluded Donald Trump from ever becoming the candidate in the first place.
So be careful what you wish for.
Absolutely.
Is the final warning. I'm afraid that we've all out of time, Zenya. I don't get to ask you about what the fixes are pre-2020. We'll have to speak to you in the coming days, which I will look forward to doing as we learn the outcome. Thanks, Zenya, for being with us. Thanks, James Boyes, too, for being on today's Midori House. The show is produced by Tom Hall, researched by Yaline Goffin, Judith Serra and Jake Fitzsimmons. And our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next, Culture with Robert Bound at 1900. Do tune into Monocle 24 over what is sure to be, either way, a pretty extraordinary next 24, 48 hours. This is Midori House. Thanks for tuning in.